Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Jonathan R. Latham, Ph.D. He's co-founder and executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project and the editor of Independent Science News. Dr. Latham is also the director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. Dr. Latham holds a master's degree in crop genetics and a Ph.D. in virology. He was subsequently a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Genetics, University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's published scientific papers in disciplines as diverse as plant ecology, plant virology, genetics, and genetic engineering. Dr. Latham talks frequently at international events and scientific and regulatory conferences on the research conducted by the project. He's written for Truthout, MIT Technology Review, The Guardian, Resilience, and many other magazines and websites. Today, we talk about unexpected antibiotic resistance in gene-edited cattle. So can you start with the basics, like first, what is gene editing, what is antibiotic resistance, and then move into the current topic?
Yeah, sure. That's not so simple. But the gene editing is a method that is, you know, the biotech industry is presenting to be completely different from a GMO. So the idea of gene editing, as far as they're concerned, is that you put in an enzyme into a cell, and that enzyme changes the sequence of the DNA and then disappears, and then from that cell you grow up a plant or an animal which has been altered in a way that they intend. But you know, many aspects of this we'll find out in the course of this discussion, many aspects of that idea are essentially fraudulent, in that what these techniques really are is very, very similar to the old techniques of GMO and genetic engineering. And so what is happening in the case of these cows is that because what you're doing is essentially so similar to the old GMOs, they've ended up being exactly resembling old GMOs with basically foreign DNA inserted in them. And so the idea, the gene editing idea, is as much PR as anything else. That's why it's a little difficult for me to explain exactly what it is, because essentially it's a PR idea in at least as much as it's a new technology. So the idea of editing is that, you know, you just are changing a T to a C, or a, you know, equivalent in book writing or article writing of changing, you know, a D to an X or whatever. That is the kind of metaphor that they want to put into the public's head. But really, this metaphor is so wildly different from the reality that it becomes actually difficult for somebody like me to explain what's going on. But essentially, what they're really doing is they're taking, what they did was they took a cow cell, they could basically an embryo, what would become an embryo. They inserted into that a set of enzymes and some foreign DNA, and this foreign DNA was intended to create a phenotype, basically a cow without horns. And but in order to do that, you couldn't just make a simple editing change. What you had to do was insert a whole sequence of DNA that's several hundred base pairs long, and in order to even generate that piece of DNA that's 200 base pairs long, what you need is a whole set of genetic sort of apparatuses, vehicles, DNA vehicles, to basically to organize that change and to grow up that piece of DNA. And what the company in this case didn't do is they didn't separate out the vehicle from the DNA change they wanted. So the vehicle, which has antibiotic resistance genes and so forth in it, ended up in the cows themselves. So they took, basically, they used a kind of Frankensteinian method of basically electrocuting the cells that they were, the cell that basically the embryo cell, they took an embryo cell from a cow. They used this kind of electrification method to basically introduce that the DNA, and then they grow up the cell. They basically reimplant that cell into another cow, and they have it grow up, and they hope to develop they're gene edited animals from that.
So how is this different than regular style genetic modification?
That's a great question, because the answer is not very much, right? Basically hardly at all. So what they've done is they've introduced this new technology, or what they're calling a new technology, which is quote-unquote gene editing, which is, in principle, gene editing. If it was really a thing, if there really was a thing called gene editing, it would be very, very different from the from genetic modification, which is basically using a gene gun or using a bacterium to shoot in foreign DNA taken from another organism, from a bacterium, from a fish, from a fungus, for example, or another plant species or another animal species. And genetic modification is when you add that, and then you grow up the resulting organisms, and you find one that has the property that you want, that it kills insects or resists fungi or resists viruses. So that is the sort of the big picture idea behind genetic modification. And in this case, even though they're calling it gene editing, they've essentially done the exact same thing, right? So the bottom line answer, the very simple answer to your question is, there's no difference. But the whole presentation of the biotech industry is that this is completely different and it doesn't require regulation.
I guess we kind of get to the point there with that last phrase, don't we, with it doesn't require regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a big deal for them. Yeah. They would like to basically be able to do their work unhindered. And they see regulation as a huge obstacle to what they want to do. Yeah.
And from the perspective of those who are doing this, one of the claims they make, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, as you say in your article, gene editing is seen by many as the ultimate in precision breeding. So they would argue that there's no, that essentially this is just taking, you know, old school breeding the best cows, or breeding in this case the cows with the with the more and more vestigial horn, or less and less horn, however you want to say it. This would just be seen as sort of speeding up that process. Is that correct?
Well, they are part of a, you know, there's so much PR in all this. You know what I mean? It's quite difficult for us to separate out the reality, because, you know, there are some people who are trying to do something that's a little bit closer than what these cattle breeders were doing. That comes a little closer to actual editing. And then there are people like these cattle editors who basically have ended up doing genetic modification. And so there is a, you know, I've gone and forgotten precisely your question, but there's a variety of different people who are trying to do slightly different things, but they're all trying to do it under the rubric of this gene editing thing, which doesn't require regulation. That is their spiel. So when this paper was originally published, so these cows were made several years ago, and they published their paper. And they basically claimed there was no extraneous DNA, that they'd really done a gene editing type change to these animals. And what's now coming out is that FDA has gone and, for reasons that are kind of interesting to discuss, gone and taken their DNA and sequenced it and found out really that what they did was not very similar to gene editing. It's something really quite different. So the FDA has basically undermined the whole lack of regulation rationale behind this, because what they're exposing is really genetic modification under a different name.
And in this specific case, what ended up happening, just sorry if this is a dense question, but one of the things that ended up happening is that the cattle had resistance to antibiotics in their very genes. And so does this mean that they're, that those cattle and then their offspring would that bacteria? So what would happen if they get sick and then you try to give them antibiotics to make it so they're not sick.
Yeah. Well, there are a bunch of different answers to that, right? One is that, you know, they're producing this gene that is, quote-unquote, an antibiotic resistance gene, but it probably only really works in bacteria, right? So all of these proteins, every piece of DNA, despite the rhetoric, every piece of DNA requires its environment to work in. So if you take a gene from a bacterium and you put it into a cow, for example, it's likely not to do the same thing, or not likely not to function at all. So probably what happens inside these cattle is that the gene is either the protein that's coded for by the gene probably doesn't get produced, or if it does get produced, it doesn't work much, if at all. But what's interesting about these animals is that essentially you put a bacterial gene into them, and that what that means is that bacteria which live in their gut, which, for example, digest, you know, gut cells all the time, like your gut sloughs off cells, they get digested by the bacteria that live inside your stomach, those bacteria can take up that gene, and they may well find it useful. And in this case, there are actually two different antibiotic resistance genes in these cows. And they will, those genes are present in every cell of the entire organism. Right? So just as the hornless trait is in principle present in every cell of the whole organism, so are these antibiotic resistance genes. So this is one of the worries, that, you know, inside the urine, inside the poop of the cows, when they're eaten by you, for example, then, you know, if you eat a steak made from these cows, you will be eating the antibiotic resistance genes, and your bacteria in your stomach may decide to take those up, right? They may acquire them. And so this is the worry, really. It's not that the bacteria, the cows will be antibiotic resistant themselves. It's that the bacteria, any bacteria that come in contact with this cow, right, no matter where they are, whether, you know, if the cow gets, you know, washed downstream in some, you know, unusual accident or whatever, or it gets into your stomach, or it gets used as pet food, for example, wherever that animal flesh ends up, the bacteria resistance genes will also be there.
Well, there's two directions to go with this. One of them is, can we talk about antibiotic resistance a little bit? And I want to come back specifically to gene editing in a moment, but can we talk about antibiotic resistance? Because it seems, I was just talking with a friend about this 2 days ago, that we are living in a very, very short blip of antibiotic usefulness. And it seems that is, on a evolutionary scale, coming to a close pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that there are, you know, I'm not an expert in this, but, you know, there are a whole ton of people who are concerned about antibiotic resistance. And there's very good reasons for that. And yet the animal industry, for example, the cow industry and the dairy industry and the pork industry, these and the chicken industry, these industries are using these antibiotics in massive quantities. And the farming and fish farming industry, by the way, too, using these antibiotics in huge quantities in ways that, you know, basically medical doctors believe is totally inappropriate, and I would agree with that, yeah.
And I know you're not an expert in this, but let's talk, I mean, people may not know this, so let's talk just a little bit more. Like, I just read 2 days ago that antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis is very much on the upswing, and the same with some forms of sexually transmitted diseases. That there is increasingly, and my sister actually had to have part of her skull removed because she had MRSA that was completely antibiotic resistant, and they couldn't do anything. They could not get it was in her bone, and they couldn't get rid of it except through actually removing a small part of her skull.
Yeah. I mean, you know, my understanding is that this is becoming more and more common. People are getting overgrowth of in their guts, for example, of bacteria that, you know, you take an antibiotic and it kills everything except the bacteria, that a few bacteria in your stomach or a few bacterial types that have a resistance. And then all of a sudden you end up with a monoculture of bacteria in your stomach that are not good ones.
And let's
so there's
go
many,
back.
Many ways in which antibiotic resistance can be a problem, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Let's go back to gene editing. One of the problems with the scenario that you just laid out, if I'm understanding you correctly, and one reason I keep coming back to this is fairly complicated, and honestly, I'm not quite understanding it. So one of the problems, let me know if this is correct, one of the problems is that we were told that this gene editing would not introduce would not lead to unforeseen side effects, and we're now finding that that's not true. Is this am I understanding correctly, or am I still missing it?
Yeah, that is part of the paradigm, right? Part of the paradigm of genetic engineering was also that, you know, you make one genetic change, you change one gene out of 40,000 that an organism might have, and that the essential final result is an organism that's merely changed in having less horns, or having, you know, a resistance to a bug or a virus or some, you know, heat resistance. The same company that made these hornless cattle is also making heat resistant cattle, you know, which is an interesting thing in itself, because they basically want these animals to live closer to the equator. So that's something that we probably would want to think about questioning, you know, from the outset. But essentially, what originally was a story of genetic modification is that the changes are very specific. What is still the story of gene editing is that the changes that will be made will be very specific. You know, you'll be able, if you want cows without horns, you can have cows without horns, and there will be no other alteration to them. But that paradigm is basically that is essentially not supported by science. You know, there's a whole bunch of organisms that have been edited, you know, more or less accurately, so far as we know, that then turn out to have unanticipated properties. Like there's one that had less vertebrae than it was expected to. So this company made a new animal, and they wanted it to have a specific change, and it ends up having these developmental abnormalities. So this kind of thing is, I would say, is to be expected, right? Because essentially, changing an organism is kind of like changing the economy, or changing the internet, or changing something on your computer, right? It's a very, very complex system. And if you go and change one thing on your computer, you remove one line of code, or you add a new line of code, you can't guarantee that there will be only one outcome. And this is the paradigm that we should apply to organisms. They're very complicated, so if you try to change them, there will be ramifications, right? And what the genetic engineers and the gene editors want you to believe is that there will be no ramifications from these changes. But, there's a totally different mindset, biological life mindset, between people who think you can just change one thing and that will be the end of the matter, versus people, and I would be in that camp, who think that you can't just change one thing, right? And it's very simple to understand why you can't just change one thing. Imagine that you succeeded in making a totally accurate and totally specific change in the DNA of an organism so that you just added one gene. Well, if you add one gene, that gene also has to produce RNA, and it also has to produce a protein, and that protein is probably an enzyme that does various things inside the cell. It uses metabolites, it creates other metabolites. All of a sudden, you can perfectly well see that that adding the gene and adding the protein and adding the RNA is not just one change, even within that limited sense of what a change is. But you can also easily imagine that the depletion of metabolites and the accumulation of other metabolites in other places will also have ramifications on the functioning of that organism. And that's presumably what's going on in the case of these animals with the wrong number of vertebrae and so forth. That these little changes, what you think of very subtle and uninteresting or unimportant changes end up ramifying across the organism. In the same way that if you change a line in your computer, you may find that next time you turn on your computer, it doesn't even work at all, even though you just changed something in your Word program. This is what can happen with organisms. And there's no big surprise about this. This is just about complex systems. But so there's a whole bunch of people who nevertheless cling to the paradigm of precision change, which is basically they need to do for the in order to satisfy, let's think about this, the public, their investors, but also the regulators. Right? Everybody wants to believe in one way or another, who's in the industry at least, wants to believe in this idea of precision change, which is not supported ultimately by the science.
You know, back in the 80s, is when I grew to understand sort of a cultural hypocrisy about this, that that there was a downturn. I was living in the Pacific Northwest, and there was a downturn in the Japanese housing market, and or maybe an upturn. I don't remember which. Doesn't matter. But the point is, everybody who lived in the region understood that the Japanese housing market affected the housing market in the timber country because it increased or decreased the demand for timber here. So the point is that the Japanese everybody understood that the Japanese housing market affected life in Colville, Washington. And it seems that when you have the economy, people understand that there are these complex interactions. But suddenly when they get to the natural world, they think, oh, we can remove beavers and it won't make any difference. Or we can remove wolves and it won't make any difference. Or we can remove mosquitoes and it won't make any difference. And the same thing seems to apply at the genetic level. That it seems extraordinary to me that, I mean, there is this hypocrisy that they do understand how this works when it comes to protecting the economy. But then they get really stupid when it comes to protecting the natural world or protecting, or anyway, I'm just rambling. You can take that anywhere you want.
No, this is what you identify is a really important point. You know, we have a special set of laws, if you like, biological principles that we apply to the natural world that essentially attempt to deny that, what you just described, right? Is that, you know, if you add these part to an ecosystem or you take some away, that essentially it's either predictable or will make no difference. And these things are not true. And actually, one day I'm hoping you'll interview me about a book that I'm writing, which is kind of about this, which is basically that if you, and you know, what we're speaking about here in many ways is genetic determinism, right? It's basically the idea that if I've gene edited a cow, I've basically made a gene-edited cow with, you know, extra horns or no horns, right? And that you can just guarantee that that will happen. And essentially, we have a whole, you know, biological science essentially is devoted to generating that mythology around organisms, that you can basically make these single changes. And what the way the organism basically works is our, you know, theory of biology is that everything is determined, controlled, organized by a piece of a molecule, a biochemical called DNA, that exists inside the organism. And we try to build from that a whole theory of how humans function, how these cattle function, how, you know, wolves out in the wild function, that essentially flies in the face of a huge amount of evidence and data and reality. But we try to impose this standard. You know, this is what we teach in school, right? For example, textbooks, they organize in many ways. They theorize around organisms in terms of DNA. So they will talk, they will, for example, you know, they will not teach students much of anything about ecology, but they'll teach students a vast amount about DNA and the functioning of DNA and the central dogma and all these aspects of how the organism is supposed to work. that is basically incorrect. Right? It's basically, it's not even been discovered by biologists that organisms actually work this way. But we have a whole theory of biology which is designed to basically impose what ultimately is just a dogma, right, on the functioning of organisms. Organisms are really self-organizing complex systems. What they do is, you know, if I poke you, for example, a whole bunch of things might happen, right? One is that you may just bounce back. You know, I poke you in the stomach and your tummy just bounces back and absolutely nothing happens. Or I could poke you in a different place and you might have a heart attack, or you might have, you might go blind, or you might get angry with me and poke me back, and we end up in a fight, right? This is how poking works, right? You make a subtle change, and sometimes nothing happens at all to that organism, and sometimes it flies into a rage and, you know, crashes its car and dies or something. You know, there's all these basic possibilities that can happen when you change an organism. And what our society basically is in many ways an attempt to deny those things, right? And what you're basically denying about the organism is free will, right? You're basically saying that organisms do not have free will, and your substitute theology, if you like, for that organisms having free will is this whole idea of genetic determinism, in which, you know, a wolf is a wolf is a wolf, and it doesn't matter if it's living in the city, and it doesn't matter if it's a country wolf, it doesn't matter if it's surrounded by its family or not, that it will just behave in these certain ways. And the same with people. You know, we imagine that people are just people, and they have this kind of, you know, self inwardly controlling way of being that is not affected by its environment. And that's not our observation, right? If you put people in a happy place, they'll be happy. And if you put them in an unhappy place, they'll be unhappy. It's really not the reality. But the whole of Western civilization really is based on this idea that these organisms are unchangeable, right? That you can basically, you can do things to organisms. Like you put them in prison, and you put them in prison because they're the same person they were 5 years ago who committed a murder, or took drugs, or whatever, you know, whatever they were convicted of, that you can take this person 5 years later and you can put them in prison and you're basically punishing them. But biological reality is that that organism that you put in prison after 5 years has firstly changed as a human being. It may not even agree with what it did in 5 years previously. You know, may wish it hadn't, it may have repented, may have apologized, whatever it is. But the law doesn't care. Right, and but the other part of this is that that biological organism, the molecules inside it are completely different. Right, they almost have, you know, your molecules turn over. I think every roughly 8 weeks or so they will turn over from, and you will be basically a different person. And so essentially you've got an organism that has a superficial resemblance to the one that it was 5 years ago, but really is totally different in its, probably it's a mindset, and certainly in its actual molecules that it's composed of. But if we didn't all agree on that point, then essentially our civilization wouldn't be able to function in the way that it currently does. So we have to agree on this, and the biological formulation of all this is genetic determinism, and that's the mythology that these biotechnology enthusiasts are basically. They've bought that hook, line, and sinker.
Well, I'm thinking what you've said about, you know, you can go in and modify something, or, you know, the poke may lead to nothing, or it may lead to catastrophe, or, you know, it is highly unpredictable in some mm-hmm. ways. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking about, one could go in, presumably, and alter some gene and have no effect. It could have an expected effect, or it could have an unexpected effect. And mm-hmm. I keep thinking about what Paul Ehrlich has said about biodiversity crash. And he compares driving creatures extinct to popping rivets on a plane. And, you know, one rivet may pop off and it's no big deal. Fiverr of its may pop off, but you know, if there's at some point there will be a rivet that will pop off that will cause the wing to fail. And it seems that it's like you said about changing lines of code. It's very possible you change a line of code and it makes absolutely no difference to your computer. It's possible that it makes it does exactly what you wanted, nothing else. It's also very possible that it has some catastrophic effect. It's the same with this, that it seems I'm just reiterating what you said, that they're pretending it's predictable when it's not.
I mean, this is such an important idea of our civilization. And so we have, you know, what ends up happening is that, you know, if we want to escape from this genetic determinist way of thinking, we have to, you know, basically think about the economy or think about the computer in a very realistic way. And the way this works out in practice is that, you know, instead of our brains engaging with how the economy works or how a computer works, we just run tests, we run models, we run all these kind of computer programs and stuff to try to understand what is the implication of the change that we've made or that we might want to make. But essentially, the human brain, and nobody is basically competent to understand the changes the effects that a single change will make, right? If you've got a complex system with, you know, hundreds of moving parts, there's no way of you actually predicting what will happen. So what the biologists basically have to do is attempt to pretend that they really understand, and fundamentally they don't.
Well, that reminds me of David Ehrenfeld's line about the world is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking.
Yeah, and that goes for climate change modeling, that goes for all kinds of stuff.
Oh, it goes for everything. Another part of this is I keep wondering there's a different direction I want to go first, which is that that this is actually inherent in sort of, and you know, my first degree was in physics, so I understand science okay. And you know, the scientific method, or much of what I was taught, is that you take some idea. You have an idea, and so what you do is you move this idea into a laboratory where you can eliminate all variables but one, and then you test your hypothesis based on one cause leading to one effect, and then you take that experiment, say it's successful, and yes, my theory works. And then you go back and reapply that to the larger world. And that is certainly useful for some applications, but it seems that inherently it has the problem that you're talking about today of, by definition, eliminating context from your entire, sorry to use a big word here, but your entire epistemology, how you determine whether something is true. You've removed context by definition by putting it into a laboratory and then generalizing back out. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So what happens when biologists, you know, bring their organism into the lab and they simplify the environment and they simplify the food that it's given and so on and so forth, is that they are, you know, they do their experiment and they think they discovered how the thing works. And then they don't usually bother to take it back out into the environment and see whether that's still really true or not, because essentially the thesis, you know, their genetic determinist thesis of this is how a frog works or whatever, is so, you know, it's so wrong that if they were to take it out into the environment, they would find that it probably doesn't work in the way they thought it did, right? But they're really not interested. They don't even want to know, right? You know, if you start changing all these multiple parameters and stuff, they become angry and confused, and essentially, you know, you're bucking the system, right? To disavow this genetic determinist idea. But if you take organisms inside all the time and you simplify their environment and you simplify their food and you simplify, you know, their social relations and so forth, it enables you to create the illusion and maintain the illusion, not disturb the illusion, that this is really how these organisms work. Because everybody, you know, every scientist is taking their certain species into the lab. You know, so you have your Drosophila, right? If you read the Drosophila literature, this is a fruit fly. You read the literature, everyone keeps their animals under the same conditions. They're all keeping them at 25 degrees C on a defined medium in a cage of a certain dimension with a, you know, programmed day lengths and so on and so forth. Everybody is doing that. And if you start doing experiments outside of those parameters, you become kind of an outcast. You become a weirdo. People lose interest in what you do. So there's this whole kind of set of norms and values that people have. So they're kind of interlinked with each other in this very complex way to not disturb the whole kind of thesis, because it's so easily disturbed. You know, it's so obviously wrong that you have to have these norms and expectations and social control mechanisms, really, to kind of maintain it as an illusion.
You know, I know I keep hammering this, but I think this is such an important point that that the unintended consequences, which is in some ways what we're talking about here, with they thought they were just going to make them cattle without horns, and they added this antibiotic resistance to it. It ended up in there. That, you know, my life is a series. That's true for all of us. My life is a series of unintended consequences. And one great example is that I have Crohn's disease, and they don't know what causes Crohn's disease. But one of the serious contenders for a thesis is that it has to do with increased hygiene. That increased hygiene has made it so humans who evolved with various intestinal parasites now have fewer whipworms and hookworms. And one of the things that whipworms do, which is pretty cool, is they attach to your gut, and then they modulate your immune system. And one of the theories is that people with Crohn's disease have a hyperactive immune system, and if I had a whipworm infestation, and I've taken whipworms under the guidance of my gastroenterologist, and they've seemed to really help. Anyway, the point is that the whipworms modulate your immune system. And that's just one example of how hygiene, which you would think in general is a great idea, sure, let's increase hygiene because nobody really wants intestinal parasites, and I'm not being sarcastic at all, but one side effect is that some certain percentage of the population, let's presume this thesis is true about the cause of Crohn's, some certain percentage of the population is going to end up with this other disease because of it, because you're messing with evolution.
I mean, this is you know, another aspect of this thesis is that your immune system in general relies on the existence of bacteria in your gut to develop, right? So this is, you know, this is a variation of your whipworm thesis. You know, there's absolutely, totally this kind of, you know, there's no barrier to the organism, right? This is about interdependence and interconnectedness and so forth that we're, you know, spend all our time attempting to deny. Right, that you know, these whipworms, you know, they are benefiting themselves, but also your body has learned to rely on them, for example, to do what it needs to do, and so you've got all these organisms, and when you try to understand this thesis about how organisms are genetically determined, this is one of the reasons why this is such an important thesis. Right, and why, you know, I want to argue that is one of the basic elements of Western civilization, is that there is no boundary to an organism, right? If you try to identify where that is, right, does your organism, do you end at your skin, or do you end at your hair, or do you end at your gut, or do you end at the bacteria that live on your gut, or do you end at the organisms in your family, the people that you socialize with, or the people that you reproduce with, or whatever, like, or the people whose ideas that you share, for example, to put this on a mental level, to imagine that there are isolated organisms is a very, very complex illusion, and one that is so important to the way we live today.
You know, I wrote a book back in 2005 or 2006 or somewhere in there about zoos. And one of the things I said was that zoos teach us a really awful lesson. They teach a bunch of awful lessons. And one of the awful lessons they teach us is that you can remove a wolverine from a forest and still have a wolverine. And you can put a wolverine in a cage and it is still a wolverine. And that's presuming that a wolverine is just a sack of DNA, a first sack full of DNA. So I think that you and I are completely agreeing on this, that I think that if you take a wolverine out of a forest, you no longer have a wolverine. You have this miserable creature in a cage.
Yeah, that will get repetitive. You know, will basically become mentally ill, for example. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And another thing that I just have to every time we have a conversation, I want to bring this up, and I don't think I brought it up yet. It's like, have none of these scientists ever read The Myth of Icarus? And did they never see The Sorcerer's Apprentice when they were kids?
I mean, I personally haven't read The Sorcerer's Apprentice. So possibly there's possibly plenty of people who haven't.
The plot of The Sorcerer's Apprentice, very briefly, is that the sorcerer goes away and he leaves his apprentice in charge of the workshop.
Yeah.
And the apprentice knows just enough magic to be able to dabble and causes terrible trouble because he thinks that he can, you know, just make the brooms work on their own, and the brooms carry in water, but he doesn't know how to control any of this stuff, and ends up having all sorts of unseen ramifications that basically trashes the place.
Yeah. Well, if you want to make change in the world, you've got a few fairly simple choices. You know, one is that you can pretend to people that you can understand what's going to happen when you make the change, or you can tell people really you have no idea. And the reality is that we have no idea in 99% of cases. And so, but if you're going to do that, if you're going to make that change and say you have no idea, how many people are going to go along with what you want to do? The answer is not very many, because you probably are doing it because you're the beneficiary, right? And so it's totally necessary for these scientists to believe in this myth and disregard Icarus and sorcerers and all the rest of these, you know, stories that we have and the precautionary principle and so on and so forth, that the theoretical and social feedback that they, you know, presumably get from their friends or whatever it is, they have to ignore these stories and these ideas. And so if they do read The Sorcerer's Apprentice, they quickly attempt to forget it.
And, you know, you really hit the core of it when you said when they benefit, because one of the things that always strikes me about whenever we talk about so-called unintended consequences is the first thing I think about is dams. And, you know, there are even people who call themselves environmentalists who are not opposed to dams, but everybody understands that dams kill anadromous fish and they kill the lands they inundate. Those aren't really if you have salmon run up a river and then you put a dam in, it doesn't take a cognitive giant to figure out that it will not be an unintended consequence, an unanticipated consequence, that the salmon can't go past the dam. It's just, or if you bathe the world in endocrine disruptors, that's going to have some effect. I don't understand.
No, the same thing is happening with these recombinetics cattle, right? It's a total no-brainer, right? They've taken a medium and they've taken a cow cell and they've put two types of DNA into the medium before they, you know, shock it with the electricity. Basically try to get the DNA into the cell. They put DNA they want to be in the cell in there with DNA they don't want to be in there. And instead of purifying away the DNA that they didn't want to, they're just, you know, presumably cowboys, they've just stuck in, they basically failed to separate the two kinds of DNA, and so they both end up in the final product. It's so obvious, it's almost unbelievable that they would do this, but they did it. And, they did two things. They put it in there in the first place, and then they didn't check that it was absent when they made the animal, right? So they made two mistakes, and they're both incredibly obvious things to do wrong, but they did them anyways. And this is what's kind of interesting about these people, is that everybody is pretending that these kinds of mistakes won't get made, and nobody more than the company themselves. They actually put the DNA into the solution. They got in there, and then they didn't want to be there. And Brazil apparently now has cancelled their... They had a project in Brazil, which the Brazilian government has now cancelled because of this discovery.
You know, it just... I don't know about you, but I know in my own personal life that... I mean, if there is a mistake that I can make, I mean, if I'm working on a car, if it is possible for me at some point to drop a wrench, I will drop a wrench.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just something that if you're working on things, you take into account that various mistakes can be made.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Okay, so we have like 2 or 3 minutes left, and can you spend... Okay, so you have two choices. Either sum up some other way, or maybe end by talking a little bit. You mentioned the precautionary principle, and if you think it's appropriate, can you end by talking about the precautionary principle a little bit? Or, again, you can go a different direction.
Well, you know, I would like to talk about the precautionary principle, because, you know, this is something about which we have cognitive dissonance, right? What these people need is a precautionary principle. Of course, this extra DNA is likely to get in there because they put it in the solution in the first place. What's interesting about the precautionary principle is that all these companies, you know, Cargill and Monsanto, they will, you know, if you bring up, you know, try to put into some piece of international or national legislation something about the precautionary principle, they will totally... you know, attempt to blow you away. They won't even let you use the wording and so on and so forth. They will really go utterly ballistic. And, yeah, they use the precautionary principle all the time, right? When they want to put out a new product, they make sure, you know, they try to clear away the opposition. They try to head off, potentially upset investors. They basically use the precautionary principle all over the place, you know, when they try to, you know, frame it in a nice way for the media and so on and so forth. What you're doing is employing the precautionary principle to do something. And yet, when it comes to public safety and protecting the environment, they totally ignore and, in fact, will vehemently deny any interest in the precautionary principles. I just want to bring up that kind of double standard. You know, we've talked about double standards a couple of times, but I think the precautionary principle, which they, you know, treat so rudely in the media and so forth, is totally one of those examples, a classic.
Yeah, the precautionary principle applies to we will not do anything that will harm our profitability. It does not apply to we will not do anything that harms the real world.
Yeah, that's the double standard, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for this. I think this is going to be really important for people to hear, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Jonathan Latham. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Thanks for your questions, Derek.